or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is Laura, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the May 24th issue of the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Hooters says bring the kids. The chain known for skimpy uniforms and bikini nights is trying to change its image. Hooters onesie, anyone? By Alessandra Shade. It's a crisp spring night, and the 25 televisions at Hooters are showing baseball, hockey, and basketball. For decades, the chain has provided a haven for men who like to congregate over cold beer, hot chicken wings, and hotter waitresses. On a night like this, the Hooters in East Brunswick, New Jersey, should be packed. And it is. But in addition to the guys watching sports, the place is filled with children and their parents. Beneath a sign that reads, "Caution, Blonde's Thinking," a six-year-old girl sips soda through a bendy straw. Nearby, members of a middle school baseball team wolf down funnel fries at a table printed with Hooter swimsuit calendar girls. In a corner, a server wearing hot pants hands balloons and crayons to young girls fresh off a dance performance. Three 26-year-old men who have stopped in after a day of golf are surveying the scene from a high-top table. "We're surprised there are so many kids here," says Robbie Holmes, who works in construction. "We weren't expecting baseball teams and families. It's crazy." Hooters was founded in 1983 by six Florida businessmen who got together to open a place they couldn't get kicked out of, according to the company website. At the first Hooters in Clearwater, Florida, an all-female waitstaff in revealing outfits served the wings, burgers, and beer. The founders soon opened more locations and licensed the Hooters name to entrepreneurs. At its peak, the chain had more than 420 restaurants across 42 states and 29 countries, and for 3 years, a Hooters airline. Private equity firms eventually took control of the locations that weren't run by the men who had started it all. After a series of ownership changes, the company was more or less split in two. Hooters Inc., the branch controlled by the founders, and Hooters of America, which was run by the franchisers. As the waitstaff uniforms grew skimpier at many locations, Hooters Inc. and Hooters of America had disagreements over the company's brand identity. Business suffered because of the 2008 recession and changes in dining habits. The pandemic dealt another blow. Weighted down by debt and declining sales, Hooters of America closed dozens of locations before filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in March 2025. In recent months, the original owners have moved to reclaim much of the business, acquiring roughly 140 locations with a plan to re-Hooterize the brand. The effort is led by Neil Kiefer, who was once the founder's lawyer and is now the chief executive. He aims to return Hooters to what he described as its core identity, a casual place with a family-friendly vibe. "There's a lot to clean up, Kiefer, 74, said in an interview. Under private equity control, Kiefer argued, the franchise operators leaned into more overtly sexual marketing, notably a 2021 decision to introduce uniforms that resemble underwear. "We're getting back to what makes us a beach-themed restaurant as opposed to a girly bar," Kiefer said. To peg Hooters as a beach-themed restaurant overlooks the aesthetic that was there from the start, when the chain promoted its servers as Hooters Girls. It had a successful side business publishing a calendar featuring its employees in bikinis. Although the Hooters in East Brunswick is not among the restaurants controlled by Kiefer, it is taking a page from the family-friendly approach now endorsed by the original team. There's a Kids Eat Free promotion on Saturdays, and Hooters-branded baby onesies are for sale at the merchandise counter. Yet, it still holds the occasional bikini night, with servers doing their jobs in swimwear. It's a current topic of debate, Kiefer said of the Bikini Nights. You'll never see one of those in one of our stores, and hopefully we'll get everybody in line with that, too. The decor at the East Brunswick location shows that the makeover is far from complete, with framed photos of servers in racy costumes on the walls and a TV playing a slideshow of the Bikini Nights on a loop. The waitstaff uniforms have more material than they once did, but the servers are still outfitted in low-cut V-necks and tight orange shorts. Amid the new family-friendly push, online forums have filled with parents debating whether Hooters is an appropriate place for children, with commenters arguing everything from bodies aren't inherently sexual, let the kids eat wings, to calling the chain sleazy and gross. Dave Ockram, 39, and his wife, Lisa Ockram, 43, said they were surprised to see so many other parents with children when they walked in with their two sons, ages 2 and 12. I don't think it's too risque or perverse, David Ockram said. Besides, the food is genuinely good. Another customer, Lexi Pagoda, 38, a stay-at-home mother, agreed. I'm pretty conservative with this kind of stuff, she said, but I don't think it's vulgar, if that's what people say. Five children, ages 1 to 15, sat nearby, part of a family group at a long table. Elsewhere in the room, Leslie Dagdag, 41, said she often dined here with her family. I've asked my friends, is it weird we take our kids to Hooters? She said. And they're like, yeah. Alan Renault, 44, said his 9-year-old daughter had won a purple unicorn from the claw machine. It's just a good vibe, he said. Kitschy decor and upbeat music, from Taylor Swift to Guns N' Roses, keep the place loud and loose. The servers are skilled in making a production out of birthdays, standing kids on chairs, and giving them menus to flap like wings, said Anna Petrillo, a 23-year-old Hooters waitress. For adult males, the servers take a different approach, stuffing their shirts with paper towels to simulate breasts, Petrillo added. Over the years, Hooters has faced its share of legal challenges. In 1997, the company reached a settlement with a group of men who filed a discrimination lawsuit alleging that they had been denied jobs at the chain because of their sex. As part of the deal, Hooters agreed to employ men in support roles. In 2011, the National Organization for Women sued to bar minors from Hooters restaurants in California, an effort that proved unsuccessful. Armour Henry, 23, a bartender at the East Brunswick location, said she tried to put every customer at ease, especially those who don't fit the usual demographic. Women might feel uncomfortable here, she said, so we pay special attention to them. We're immediately complimenting her, like, oh, you're so pretty. Although the Hooters girls set the tone in a space built around the performance of female friendliness and flirtation, the parents tended not to mention them when asked about their decision to dine at Hooters. For Holmes, the man who works in construction, the waitresses were still the main draw. The wings are good, he said, but the big selling point is that there's girls here. Hasn't it always been about the women? The restaurant's name was apparently inspired by a Steve Martin comedy routine in which he made the facetious case for Hooters as the proper name for women's breasts. The owl logo is a cheeky double entendre, its gaping O eyes reinforcing the joke. The first Hooters girl, Lynn Austin, was recruited from a bikini contest sponsored by the tequila brand Jose Cuervo in 1983 and posed for Playboy 3 years later. The archetype stuck. A current job listing for Hooters calls for an all-American cheerleader, surfer, girl next door, adding sexy yet wholesome. Hooters has also been the place for a cultural rite of passage. Some fathers have taken their sons to the restaurant as a kind of initiation into heterosexual masculinity. On a recent night in East Brunswick, Arian Lapa, 47, was perched at a high top table with his son, his brother, and a nephew. It was his son's 12th birthday, and he had driven here from Staten Island to celebrate. It was a family decision, Lapa said. We brought the wives together to discuss. In a back room, a youth baseball team, along with coaches and parents, mingled after a game. Asked his favorite part about Hooters, Billy, 12, could not contain his laughter. The wings, he said, finally, to laughs from his friends. Kiefer, the executive who is trying to change Hooters' image, said the main challenge for the chain is a preconception of the brand and maybe the Bikini Nights. If Bikini Nights disappear, as Kiefer hopes they will, the regulars won't be pleased, according to Jeff Berniker, a Walgreens employee in his 60s, who said he has photographed the events at the Hooters in East Brunswick. If you're a parent and don't want your kids to see it, there's 300 other nights a year you can come in, he added. Charles Wilson, a truck driver seated in the bar area, was also against ending Bikini Nights. That's sacrilegious, he said. What the heck made you money? Hooters may now find itself in limbo. Too risque for young families and not sexy enough for certain customers. On a recent night, families crowded into the dining room. Children scribbled on Hooters coloring pages, and the Hooters girls, once the main attraction, seemed to interact more with the kids than the adults. At Leslie Dagdag's table, the mood was warm. Her extended family had negotiated clashing work schedules, childcare, and school pickups to make the night happen. It's important for us to come together like this, she said. We do feel weird about bringing our kids here, but we do it anyway. Whimsy by Brian Josephs. Liz Plank, a podcaster in Los Angeles, started her year in the doldrums. Her spirit, she felt, was being weighed down by a breakup with her longtime best friend and roommate, compounded further by the punishing news cycle. But her mood began to improve when she went to bed in her whimsy pajamas, a cream ruffled tank top and shorts. More whimsical activity followed. I started having a really cute coffee ritual in the morning, Plank 39 said. I got this really cute coffee machine, made little sprinkles, and all these little things that were just for me. And it really did transform my mood, she added. Whimsy is having a moment, thanks to Gen Zers and some millennials who have recast the word to characterize a lifestyle that blends playfulness, spontaneity, and being present. Etsy, a marketplace known for whimsy-adjacent products like handmade and vintage items, said that searches for whimsical jewelry, whimsical decor, and whimsy-related items were each up by at least 50% from last year. We're seeing shoppers turn to whimsy as a form of everyday escapism, seeking out pieces that feel personal, playful, and a little unexpected to make everyday life more extraordinary, said Dana Insom Johnson, Etsy's trend expert. And it's not just products. For example, sending postcards and doing activities one's 10-year-old self might have enjoyed are considered whimsy hobbies. There is a whimsy lexicon. Those who use it might say saunter, for example, instead of walk. At a glance, the style is a few steps away from being twee. But whimsy enthusiasts see it as a response to compounding anxieties over a series of stressors, including a challenging economy, multiple wars, and a volatile presidency. For some, embracing this brand of quirkiness amid the uncertainty offers a sense of control. We really can't control what our leaders are doing, Plank said, adding, but you can control what kind of mug you're going to choose, what cute outfit you're going to wear, and what beautiful thing you can do in your morning. For years, young people have been drawn to buzzy terms and moods to contend with societal climate. Gen Xers, who came of age in the Reagan era, dealt with cascading social and political issues, including the AIDS epidemic and the nuclear threat of the Cold War. the latchkey children, living through a period of increased divorce rates, used irony and sarcasm to cope with feelings of disillusionment. For Gen X, irony wasn't just humor, but armor. Alexandra Jacobs recently wrote in T, the New York Times style magazine. Younger generations haven't completely turned away from irony, though there are earnest social movements that have also taken hold, like the Black Boy Joy movement, which promoted images of black men and boys exuding happiness to counter negative stereotypes. In a few ways, whimsy appears to fit the current moment. Dr. Nasir Gahami, a psychiatry professor at Harvard Medical School who has written about Generation X, pointed out that millennials and Gen Z face a more intense deluge of information than the mostly internet-free society of the 1980s. He believes that whimsy also presented an out for the more performative aspects of social media. These online experiences have been going on now long enough that Generation Z and millennials have figured out that this is happening, that a lot of these online interactions are inauthentic, Gahami said. Now they have to figure out a new way more authentically engaging with each other. They realize that one way of doing that is to get offline. The whimsy's craze emphasizes on offline activities parallels a movement by young people who are leaving behind smartphones and screens. The focus on the desire to turn away from the trappings of adulthood is also conveyed by the very makeup of the word. Whimsy, a likely derivative of the 16th century noun whimwham, ends with what linguists say is often used as a diminutive suffix, which conveys a sense of childishness or affection. Laurel McKenzie, the director of undergraduate linguistic studies at New York University, said many languages have these suffixes to make words sound small or cute, like the E sound at the end of doggy. Like many ideas flirting with mainstream acceptance, the rise of whimsy has brought along some skeptics, including grammarians, who are irritated to see a noun pressed into service as an adjective in phrases like, "She is more whimsy." Others are weary of the performative aspect of the trend. Jordan Williams, an English lecturer at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, said that as someone who has experience with cosplays and makeup, whimsy has long been part of her vocabulary. In March, she posted a video on TikTok explaining that while she believed authentic whimsy still exists, the trend is more of a marketing opportunity. "You've got to buy the top five things off Amazon to find whimsy, baby. That's not whimsy," Simone, 28, said. "That's capitalism." Sean Anthony Bryant, 34, who lives in New York and works in tech, has embraced whimsy as a feeling and as a product. He conceded that he probably would not have described himself as whimsical a few years ago, but he said his fondness for being in the park and his willingness to dance in public were partly why he reconsidered. One morning, Bryant became peeved when he saw someone on social media being really negative. He made a TikTok telling viewers that since the world is on fire, they should consider doing something whimsical, like building a fort. The clip has since been viewed more than 4 million times. With some encouragement from friends, Bryant started selling t-shirts and caps that read, "Be more whimsy." Is selling whimsical clothes whimsy? Bryant says it can be. "We all have our own ways of staying whimsy," he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. "This suit makes you faster, but will runners wear it? A state-of-the-art endurance suit can enhance marathon performance and stave off the effects of fatigue if only Adidas can convince its top athletes to wear it." By Callum Marsh. Last summer, Patrick Jacobson, a senior apparel designer at Adidas, sent a team of emissaries to Kenya to present some of the world's top marathon runners including the world record holder Sebastian Saw, with the TechFit Endurance Suit, the brand's innovative running kit nearly a decade in the making. After the presentation, the reps sent a memo back to the company's headquarters in southern Germany to report the response. "We showed them the suit," the memo began, "and they all started laughing." Jacobson was not surprised by their reaction. The endurance suit, a tight, structured unitard which covers everything from the shoulders to the knees, combines deep biochemical research with cutting-edge materials technology, using bands of thermoplastic polyurethane to stabilize the pelvis and hips, an effect that the company claims reduces fatigue over long distances and confers a more than 1% increase in running economy. It's radically different than the shorts and singlets favored by elite runners, many of them from Kenya and Ethiopia. Jacobson was used to them balking at the idea of running in a full-body suit. "Every time we would show the suit to the athletes, they would just burst out laughing," Jacobson said. "The suit was almost dead quite a few times." Last month, two Adidas athletes, Saw and Yomif Kajelcha, became the first two men in history to finish a marathon in under 2 hours, racing the London Marathon in 1 hour 59 and 30 and 1 hour 59 and 41. Saw trained in the endurance suit and seemed committed to wearing it for the race. It wasn't until he was spotted at the starting line in a plain white singlet and black shorts that Jacobson learned he had decided against it. "I guess today's not the day," he remembered saying to himself. But Kajelcha did opt for the suit. "I wanted to use the suit in training as soon as I saw it for the first time," he said. "I feel the hip and back support, and I wanted to use in competition, so I did. It's a special one for me." And while it's impossible to measure precisely what impact it had on his performance, the estimated 1% improvement would be the difference between his 1 hour 59:41 and 2 hours and 1:00. In other words, it's possible that the endurance suit was the edge that got Kajelcha over the finish line in just under the historic 2 hour mark. Apparel designers have long understood that sportswear for runners has a great deal of room for improvement. In the late 1980s, the director of Nike's Sport Research Lab, Martin Shorten, developed a concept that came to be called zoned aerodynamics, which concluded that runners could benefit from a full-body speed suit constructed in different materials for each body segment, reflecting the different airflow and drag each produced while in motion. But the technology necessary to implement this idea didn't exist, so the concept was shelved until 1999, when Nike was preparing for the Olympic Games in Sydney. It was at the Sydney Games that Nike unveiled the Swift suit, a hooded one-piece suit coated in polyurethane that the Australian sprinter Cathy Freeman wore to win gold in the 400-meter run. Bright green and streamlined, the Swift suit looked like something an astronaut or a superhero might wear, but the purpose was mechanical rather than aesthetic. "The fundamental premise is that skin is slow," said George Carbo, a former researcher at Nike who worked in aerodynamics. "If you cover the skin with the right textures, you're going to get a better improvement." Despite Freeman's winning result, the Swift suit failed to catch on, partly because runners disliked the constrictive feeling, and partly because the measurable impacts were minimal. The discoveries soon made their way into other faster sports, including cycling and speed skating, where Swift suit style apparel used zoned aerodynamic principles and became the norm. "It worked fantastic for speed skating," said Lem Brownlie, a sports aerodynamics consultant for Nike. At the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002, the men who were wearing the Swift skin won all the gold medals. "It really did work. I think it changed the sport." In running, Nike shifted its focus toward alternative means of providing aerodynamic support. Nobody doing a 2-hour marathon wanted to wear a full-body suit, Carbo said. So we started asking ourselves how else we could get those textures to the skin. They developed a kind of aerodynamic tape called AeroSwift, which could be attached to the arms and legs in thin strips and built half-length tights with aerodynamic nodules running along the thighs. When Eliud Kipchoge tried to break the 2-hour marathon barrier in 2017 at the Nike Breaking 2 event in Monza, Italy, he ran wearing the AeroSwift tape and the half-length tights, which Jacobson at Adidas said was a breakthrough. Before Eliud ran Breaking 2, we were trying to get our marathon athletes to wear half tights, and they wouldn't go near them, he said. It was a split short or nothing. But as soon as Kipchoge almost broke 2 hours and did it in the tights, the runners were like, okay, maybe there's something here. Without Kipchoge doing that, a full body suit in a marathon? Completely forget about it. The Breaking 2 event, though unsuccessful, was motivating for Adidas, Jacobson said. It drove his team to look for other performance-boosting opportunities in apparel beyond aerodynamics, including cooling, airflow, and a more sophisticated kind of structural support. Several years ago, they developed a graded compression tight that would help blood flow in the leg to stave off the effects of fatigue, but the project was pricey, owing to expensive woven materials sourced from Italian suppliers. Jacobson said that while he learned a lot from the project, it didn't hit the mark. About 4 years ago, Jessica G. Hunter, a manager of athlete performance at Adidas, started looking into the effect of stiffening elements in suits for endurance runners. There was skepticism within the company that clothing could make much of a difference in a marathon. Leadership didn't think we would be able to improve running economy with apparel, Hunter said, because nobody had ever done it successfully before. Hunter found that the stabilizing elements made runners faster for longer. What we were trying to do was exploit the connection between the muscles that stabilize the pelvis and trunk and the muscles that stabilize the hip, and how those muscles tend to work together from a pelvic and hip stability, she said. In order to do that, you have to have something that crosses the whole body, and the only way to do that is with a full connected suit. Her work was handed off to Jacobson's team in Germany, where they fine-tune the stiffening elements, laser-cut bands of TPU, to find the sweet spot of science and performance with what is comfortable to wear, Jacobson said. The completed TechFit endurance suit, Jacobson said, corrects and enhances an athlete's form in a race. It functions not unlike the high-tech LZR racer built by Speedo in the late 2000s, which reinforced a swimmer's abdomen muscles to keep them more horizontal in the water. The LZR racer was so effective that it was banned from competition almost as soon as it was introduced, though not before dozens of world records were set in the suits. But while the dawn of performance-enhancing super shoes in the late 2010s provoked World Athletics to impose new regulations, banning shoes over 40 millimeters in height and with more than one carbon fiber plate, there are currently no rules in marathon running specific to apparel. These supersuits, however beneficial to runners, are entirely unregulated, perhaps in part because so few top runners have embraced them. We were hoping to make a suit that was disruptive enough that people would freak out about apparel, like they started freaking out about shoes, Hunter said. So far, it hasn't happened, which is a little disappointing, she said. If Kaldelja hadn't come in second place, it might have been a bigger deal. How milk got into your perfume bottle. Glossier, Mugler, and the Nuco are just a handful of brands selling milk-scented fragrances. By Gina Trulis. cold milk, fig milk, coconut milk. No, this isn't my grocery list for the week. Those are the scent notes on the bottles of perfumes I saw on a recent visit to my local cosmetics counter. There's You Soi by Glossier, which combines rice milk and bergamot. Angel Blush by Mugler, with almond milk and sandalwood. And First Milk by The New Co., packaged in a vessel resembling a milk bottle. At a time when young people are lining up for specialty coffees and matcha lattes, it's little surprise that savvy brands want to get in on the hype. Across culture, milk does seem to be on the mind. Trad wives are extolling raw milk, and whole milk is once again near the top of the food pyramid after the Trump administration released new dietary guidelines this year. Some fragrance makers have tied these scents to feelings of nostalgia and comfort. The New Co. describes the milky note in its perfume as our first scent memory, the soft embrace of early connection. But hold on, what does milk really smell like? Not a lot, unless it's spoiled. That's why most of these scents draw on different aroma compounds known as lactones to evoke ideas like creamy and soft that people may unconsciously associate with milk. Fragrance experts say these milky scents also involve a bit of branding sleight of hand. If you think about Abercrombie & Fitch's Fierce, it was such a great and huge fragrance, but nobody talked about what was in it, said Vicky Arslanian, a longtime fragrance distributor and the owner of Commodity, a perfume brand whose offerings include milk and the recently released Milk Orchid. Arslanian said he and his colleagues at Commodity stumbled on this scent almost by accident. The brand began with a hot and cold concept that had elements of warm marshmallow and toasted sesame. When we smelled it, we saw an image of milk, he recalled. Customers weren't always so inquisitive about scent notes, he said. A fragrance was once more what he called a closed creation. The ingredients and layers that made a perfume smell as it did were largely indistinguishable to the untrained nose. Today, because people have now a deep interest in the fragrance, the best way for us to connect to it and to speak about it is through language, and food is one of those main languages, Arslanian said. I can relate to matcha much better than I can relate to ISO-E Super, he said, referring to a synthetic aroma molecule. With trends like the clean girl aesthetic and no makeup makeup still in full force, the idea of a barely there milk scent may evoke the same natural, I woke up like this, spirit. Glossier, for example, describes its new You Soi fragrance as skin scent enhancing. And Dead Cool, a fragrance brand, has four milk-forward scents, including one that's meant to smell familiar, like warm, clean skin. Minimalist, nearly odorless perfume grew popular over the past few years as beauty became more about optimization than opulence. As the writer Rachel Sim put it in a New York Times column in 2018, writing about a wave of fragrances she termed the new softies. But when lactone compounds are mingled with other notes, like vanilla, fig, tonka bean, some of today's milky scents are distinctly foody. When I smell a milk fragrance, I get the satisfaction of a good meal, like there's something that scratches the inside of my brain, said Asia Grant, founder of Redoux, a bespoke fragrance house. Whether it's my amygdala or dopamine receptors or serotonin, whatever it is, it's the same button that's pressed after having ice cream. Grant, who's also the founder of Scent Social Club, a tour to various perfume notes in the Latia neighborhood of Manhattan, said she has received more requests for milk fragrances in recent weeks. The girls and guys love smelling like a little treat, she added. According to Sue Chan, the founder of Care of Chan, a creative agency that helps brands like J. Crew and aritzia host dinners and cocktail parties. The push of milk-scented perfumes points to how the fashion and beauty industries have embraced food to get in front of younger consumers. I think now that food, restaurant culture, is so much a part of the culture, it would make sense that brands are continuing to use food as a vehicle to reach new audiences, she said. Food is super accessible because we all have to eat 3 times or more per day, and so everyone can align with and relate to food. Customers, she added, also seem to like finding food in unexpected places. In the tomato leaf soap by Lowe, for example, or in candles sculpted to look like tinned fish or a plate of spaghetti. Some of these food-related ones are a little bit irreverent and playful, which is appealing, especially in a time that's so serious, Chan said. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Debbie Downer is enjoying an upswing. With her popular Mystical podcast, a return to Broadway in the Rocky Horror Show, and a second Tony nomination, Rachel Dratch is finally getting her due. By Cassia Pilat. Rachel Dratch wants you to know she does not have a psychic, but would it be so surprising if she did? She discusses ghosts, astral projection, and the supernatural on her weekly podcast, Woo Woo. Sometimes, because I have the podcast, I think it tips me into talking about a lot of this kooky stuff. And I'm not all about kooky stuff, she said. I guess it can come off that way, but I don't care. It might have come off that way to readers of her 2012 memoir, Girl Walks Into a Bar, since she shared a couple of the prophetic dreams and an encounter with a channeler named Kendra. That channeler accurately predicted, on Dratch's 43rd birthday, that she would one day become a mother. The next year, in 2010, Dratch gave birth to her son Eli. Dratch, now 60, manifested another dream she mentioned in the memoir, much to her fans' delight, being cast in a Broadway comedy. 4 years ago, she starred as Stephanie in POTUS, or Behind Every Great Dumbass Are 7 Women Trying to Keep Him Alive. In late March, Dratch returned to the Broadway stage, this time as the narrator in a revival of Richard O'Brien's The Rocky Horror Show at Studio 54. Not only has Dratch realized her wishes, but she has exceeded them. Both roles have earned her Tony nominations. Dratch admitted that some people in her life were surprised she was doing stage work, but she said, "That's actually where I started out." The veteran comedian, beloved for her Saturday Night Live characters like the endearing wet blanket Debbie Downer and Denise McDenna, also known as Zazu, the quintessential Bostonian, studied theater as an undergraduate at Dartmouth College, spending a semester at the National Theater Institute at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut. But her knack for improv took her to Second City in Chicago before she did 7 seasons of Saturday Night Live. Her confidence on stage and her quick wit lend themselves perfectly to the demands of the role as the narrator of the late-night double feature picture show. The role of the narrator is often performed by an older white man. But Sam Pinkleton, the director of the latest Rocky Horror revival, envisioned Dratch in that role for a reason. While the narrator can be a kind of tabula rasa, it's a crucial part too. Dratch serves as both host and guide, adding context as the story unfolds. She is also a kind of bodyguard when the audience gets too rowdy. Occasionally they do. Rocky Horror has a devoted fan base that attends the popular midnight screenings of the 1975 film version. Those events often include dressing as the characters, yelling obscenities at the screen, and throwing toast and rice in the air. Sometimes 400 people are screaming one word at the same time, which Rachel is really prepared for, said Pinkleton, who won a Tony last year for directing Oh, Mary. Sometimes One person in the balcony is screaming a line we've never heard before from their production of Rocky Horror in Ohio, he added. Dratch has to be ready for either. As an improviser, and as a host, she's in a league of her own, Pinkleton continued. Nobody can do dry, understated, commanding humor quite like Rachel. Those familiar with her character Debbie Downer know what he means. As the resident killjoy, Dratch would deliver one miserable piece of news after another, a funny bit on its own. But the punchline would arrive wordlessly, as the camera zoomed in on her dour face, accompanied by the womp-womp of a sad trombone. As the narrator, Dratch modulates her presence, which can feel understated as she steps in and out of the show. Sometimes she plays the saxophone. Other times, she strolls quietly across the stage eating popcorn. At one recent performance, the audience erupted as soon as she appeared. It's challenging to explain a joke. Something inevitably is lost in translation, which is why it can be difficult to describe the droll humor Dratch brings to the stage. She does something that is totally singular, Pinkleton said. It's not so easily definable as other actors or comedians, where it's like this is their brand. She's just, like, sneaky and elegant and genius. Stephanie Sue, one of Dratch's co-stars in Rocky Horror, was initially surprised to discover that Dratch is rather shy offstage. I think she couldn't even possibly perceive how incredibly sparkly and special she is, Hugh said. But Sue added, her shyness made more sense as she got to know her. Those who know Dratch best, like Irene Bremis, Dratch's woo-woo co-host and childhood friend from their time at Lexington High School in Massachusetts, paint her as unassuming and a great friend. I think the only thing that could either match or supersede her talent is her heart, Bremis said, adding that Dratch connects deeply with people and that it makes you feel like you're the most important person in the world. Rachel is always taking care of everything in her life that's important outside of what she has to do, Bremis added. This was evident when we met at Studio 54, as the untied laces of Dratch's black glittery sneakers dragged perilously along the floor. Tying her shoes, Bremis said, becomes like the least important thing. But even those who don't know Dratch personally are likely to find her disarmingly relatable. As when she made a cameo on the premiere episode of Good Hang, the podcast hosted by her friend and former SNL castmate, Amy Poehler. While Poehler and the other guests seem ready to start, Dratch first appeared on screen in the dark, the camera of her laptop pointed at the top half of her head as she walked through her apartment. There's a 30% chance she strangles herself, Seth Meyers quipped, as the camera cut to Dratch, holding up a set of tangled headphones framing her face. Suddenly, she was interrupted by her doorbell and her dog barking. By the time she returned to her seat, Dratch said, through teary-eyed laughter, that the batteries of her microphone had died. That's a pretty good example of who I am, Dratch said. I mean, I'm not that chaotic all the time, but that's not out of character. Let's put it that way. At a time when celebrities often curate images of perfection, mishaps like Dratch's are unexpected and refreshing. I honestly think that blooperish moment spoke to something deeper, Poehler wrote in an email. It reminded us that no one is perfect. Gentle teasing is a true love language. Hard laughs with friends are good medicine. And that Rachel Dratch is never not funny. Becoming a mother at 44 drastically shifted Dratch's perspective as well as her priorities, she said. After she left SNL in 2006, her career seemed to be slowing down, and she started to panic about her future. And then I sort of decided not to, Dratch said. 4 years later, she gave birth to Eli. Because she wasn't working as much, she was able to spend quality time with her son while he was young. It was a good lesson for me, she said. You just don't know what's coming. Instead of agonizing over her career, which she said just leads to unhappiness, Dratch enjoys going out for margaritas and laughing with friends. That's my favorite thing to do, she said. But I don't get to do it all that often. especially with the play. This play is really cutting into my marg time. Get that down. Dratch laughed, suddenly aware of how animated she had become. Marg sessions, Dratch said, were often when she would hear about her friend's esoteric encounters, which she filed away. Eventually, she would invite them to share their anecdotes on her podcast, Woo Woo. I burned through all the stories of my friends pretty quickly, she said. And now I joke around that I'm at a party and I'm like, hey, you guys ever see light flicker? Because I'm always looking for guests. When she began Woo Woo, Dratch estimated she was at, as she put it, 65% woo. The podcast has brought her up to 95%. There's no harm in crystals, she said, and though she is dubious about mediums, she's not totally closed off to the concept. The jury's still out on aliens. When it comes to astrology, I'm very much a water sign, she said. The mystics of the zodiac may also hold some answers when it comes to Dratch's ineffable appeal. What I think is really beautiful about someone like Rachel, who is so Pisces, is that her existence, her being, is sort of an invitation for us to find that within ourselves too, said Eliza Kelly, a celebrity astrologer who appeared on Dratch's podcast. So she invites people to find that play, that whimsy, that magic, that sort of ethereality within themselves. That often happens on Woo Woo, where, as Dratch and Bremis frequently discuss, they stay curious, not closed off, making sure to honor the unknown. You're going to see more magic if you're open to the magic, Dratch said. So why not be open to the magic? Modern love. Men, hide your cats. Or at least keep them out of your online dating profile pics. By Michael Zadorian. A while back, a good friend of mine who had recently divorced was thinking of getting a pet. I think he wanted some company. He came over to our house for dinner and enjoyed being around our cats, so he asked my wife and me about them. We told him that our cats are affectionate, easy to take care of, and fun to be around. I told him that if he was really interested, he should go to a good shelter and check some cats out. Often, you can just sense which one is for you. He liked the idea and left that night thinking he might get a cat. The next day, he spoke to a coworker, a woman who warned him that he should not, under any circumstances, get a cat. She said that women didn't want a man with a cat. He would never get a date, and even if he did, once that date came to his house and saw the cat, that would be it for him. Game over. She further stated that men with cats are looked upon by women as weak, feminine, and submissive. Subtext: he would never have sex again if he got a cat. Is it a surprise that he got a dog? No. And as much as I didn't like his co-worker's phobia, it turned out that science may support her claim. A man with a cat is apparently suspect in America. A 2020 study by Colorado State University revealed that women on dating apps age 18 to 24 were more likely to reject a man posing with a cat in his profile photo. Men holding cats, the study said, were viewed as less masculine, more neurotic, agreeable and open, and less dateable. I'm not sure why agreeable and open are perceived as negative traits. In the study, if men had a profile photograph without a cat, they attracted 38% of the women for a potential date or possibly even an actual relationship. Yet when women saw a picture of the same man holding a cat, the percentages dropped, with a sizable number saying they absolutely would not date a man who had a cat. After I saw the stats, I felt grateful that when my wife and I met, I had not yet identified as a cat person. Perhaps the only logical explanation why she married me. Otherwise, science assumes I'd be a forlorn cat bachelor, wads of fur on my sweater vest, living in a basement apartment filled with kitty condos, yarn toys, and my only real friends, Snowball, Mr. Waffles, and Samson J. Fluffingus, which may be closer to the truth than I care to admit. The scientists determined that women in the study were falling back on old cultural norms, Since cats are traditionally considered to be a feminine pet, men who have cats are perceived as more feminine, less masculine, and possibly gay. I find that last one particularly interesting because a friend of mine who is gay has told me that he regularly stopped by women in his neighborhood who want to pet his dog. This invariably leads to my friend telling him this, that his doggy origin story, how he found the poor little guy roaming the streets with no ID tag or microchip. After he made sure no one had reported the dog missing, he adopted him. My friend named the pup Valentino because they found each other on Valentine's Day. It's a sweet story, a sort of dog-human meet-cute, except for the animal abandonment part. After telling his story, my friend found that women were basically swiping right on him in person on the street. There have been times when I haven't been able to get away, he said. It's like they want something from me that I can't give. I can't tell you how many times I probably could have had sex because of my dog. It's clear that one must take seriously the science of dog ownership as an aphrodisiac. Since I am rather vocal about my love of cats, many people assume that I must not like dogs, which is not true. If I'm walking and see someone coming toward me with a dog, I'm always going to look at the dog first and smile and say hi, usually neglecting to acknowledge the human holding the leash. This might make me a misanthrope, but not a dog hater. My wife and I have even discussed getting a dog, but I can't take the socializing involved, especially in my neighborhood, where most of the dogs eerily get walked at the exact same time. Sometimes it's 7:45, and everyone is out walking their dog, as if an inaudible dog person whistle has summoned them. Of course, if someone is walking their dog and they run into another person with a dog, well, they have to stop and let the dog sniff each other. While that's happening, everyone talks about their dogs. Even people without dogs stop dog owners to ask, "What breed is she? Do you go to the dog park? That doggy hoodie is so cute. Is it Anthropology?" Though it's a great way to meet people if you're not crazy about small talk. I'm deliriously happy that I do not have to walk my cats. Even happier that there is no feline equivalent of dog parks. Why? Because I'm not a pack animal. You may be thinking, yeah, he sounds like a cat. Antisocial, moody, standoffish. Which is basically right. I'm a leave-me-alone kind of creature. Which is probably why I'm a writer with cats. Another problem with dogs is that they are constantly getting into altercations. As a conflict-averse individual, I don't want to have to pull down my vested Dachshund away from your snappish Frenchie in a Breton sweater, let alone a snarling, leather-clad bull mastiff. At the dog park, as in life, you never know who the bullies are until it's too late. Sooner or later, another dog is going to have a beef with your dog. Suddenly, you will find yourself in the middle of a doggy rumble, a teeth-showing, leash-tightening canine throwdown. And some owners are going to be jerks who don't care if their dog is bullying your dog. I'm not going to call this behavior masculine, but feel free to come to your own conclusions. Now, you have a beef with a human. There could be yelling, fisticuffs, even gunplay. Think I'm exaggerating? Google it. I wouldn't even get into the equally disturbing trend of owners being shot by their dogs. Again, look it up. None of this ever happens with cats. No dog park altercations, no bully breeds, no insipid street side confabs. Just me and my wife at home reading on the couch, chilling with Junebug, Cheeto, and Birdie. Maybe there's a little hissing now and then along with the errant furball, but that's about it. At a coffee house near where I live, I used to see a man who would sit at a table on the sidewalk with a pair of adorable puppies. I saw him frequently when I went there to write. Every time he showed up with the two puppies, women would swarm to his table. I would often see phone numbers being exchanged. The man obviously understood the science. He got so good at pimping his pups, he was out at the table every day. Until one day, he got so engrossed in conversation with a woman that he didn't notice when one of the puppies got loose and wandered out toward the street. Inside, I jumped up from my seat. but luckily someone outside had also been watching. She ran and pulled the puppy out of the street before anything happened. The woman he had been talking to was not pleased. No phone numbers that day for Dogman. As it turns out, my friend who was advised to not get a cat has been a dog owner for many years now. 2 years after getting the dog, he got a relationship. He remarried and has a wonderful wife and son. So maybe he owes all that to following the science. He loves his dog, but like me, is a writer and a loner. After a while, he'd had his fill of being stopped on the street by strangers to chat about or pet his dog. He now clamps in his earbuds, blasts Foo Fighters, and avoids eye contact to prevent needless human-canine interaction. Even with all that, people still stop him on the street. If someone approaches and asks if they can pet his dog, he says, "He bites." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the May 24th issue of the New York Times Style section. Your reader has been Laura. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 3 of 1929 by Andrew Ross Sorkin. Stay with us for these readings and more. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, broadcasting daily readings, 24 hours a day, of newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Radio Reading's broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Radio Reading's website is nfradioreading.org. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555.
Frontier Radio Reading Service now presents a